Okay, so since we had a emergency Shirkali today, hi Avi. I'll give a little bit of background of how we got to this point, but it's an important topic to cover, and that's why Rav Shmuel David in the end decided to send his shir along as well. And that's the question of Yerushat HaBat, right? The inheritance of daughters. Hi, Avi, again. Hi.
Question?
Yes.
Never mind.
What, Avi?
Do you have
over there. And yes, that annoys me, Avi. Okay. So here's the thing. We know that the Torah says, right, when do daughters inherit? Thank you. Yes, Ezra. Right? If there is no son, then daughters inherit. And we learned that from the celebrated story of Benot Slovchad. We didn't know it before that story. The story teaches it to us. Fine. The reality, however, is that most people living in the modern world do want their daughters to, in some way, at least functionally, inherit. And there's a series of mechanisms that are, even if they have sons, right? According to strict Torah law, daughters inherit if there are no sons. If there are sons, then daughters don't inherit anything. Many people want their daughters to inherit in some capacity, even if they have sons. And there have been many mechanisms that are used over the last many hundreds of years in order to accomplish this. And if we have time, I'll discuss some of them, right? But the question that I want to deal with is before we get that far, right, before we figure out the mechanisms that might or might not work and how they work to create a situation in which girls inherit property after their father, let's say, passes away, there is a meta question that the poskim were dealing with to figure out, and again, you know, for guys in my show, we dealt with a lot on Yerushat HaBat, what exactly is the nature of Yerushat HaBat, is it the same as Yerushat HaBen, is Yerushat HaBen unique, etc. But the question the poskim wanted to deal with was, is it religiously legitimate to utilize mechanisms that essentially let daughters inherit when there are sons? What's the question they're really asking? Right? What's the real question they're asking? Not guys from my share first. Right, I'll let them. Fine, guys from my share. Go ahead, Yaakov. But why? What's the question?
Is it that the naturally, the way the Torah wants things to inheritance to work is that males should only be the ones inheriting? Or does it, like, not care so much?
Right. Meaning, in other words, when the Torah says that daughters don't inherit, does that mean, like, yeah, boys, right, if boys are around, so they're the heirs, and, like, girls, so they don't get, right? You want to figure out how to get? Okay, because someday, do whatever you want. Or is it saying, no, boys inherit, right, when there are no girls, when there are girls. As long as there are sons, they inherit, and that's what we want, and diverging from that is fundamentally at odds with the Torah's view. And that's important. Why, Rami?
This obviously has pretty broad implications.
Why is that important? Broadly speaking, why is it important? Not elsewhere. Here, why is it important?
So if you were to hypothetically die and you wanted, like, your hypothetical children to daughter, do you also inherit, like, how logically legitimate is that?
I will say that I will one day die. That's not a hypothetical, and I do have daughters, right? Right? Like, it's one of those things, right? When you tell somebody who's, like, young and still has parents and things like that, like, you should only know simchas. What you're saying is we want you to die before your parents, so they mourn you, but you don't experience it, right? Like, we're all going to die. You don't have to say hypothetical. I will one day die, right? And I do want my children to inherit, including my daughters. So I appreciate the sentiment, but it's okay. What?
You really know that?
Yes.
I
do know that.
Mortality is only at, like, 95%, like...
No. No.
Yeah.
Listen, Rami, I get it. You believe in Kurzweiler, and you think that the singularity is near, and you're going to merge your consciousness with whatever and live forever. If that's what the future looks like, I'm a bit freaked out, and I'm not convinced that he's there, and if it, you know, to get there, he's taking 300 pills a day, you know? It's okay. It's not low a lie, right? I'm fine without it. Yeah, that's right.
It's
a really creepy book to read. It really is. I've got to say. Yeah.
Whether or not, like, loopholes should be used as
based. Right. So what I discussed with my guys yesterday is that there are many loopholes that work in the sense that technically, legally, they will be held up in court. But this is always the complexity in Torah, where it's both a legal system and a broader religious system, where some things might work legally but not be religiously suggested, appropriate, right, in line with the Torah's meta value. So the poskim in general have this idea that loopholes are legitimate to use if it doesn't do, like, fundamental damage to the belief system of the Torah, right? But even if a loophole will work, if it clearly goes against everything the Torah stands for, you should avoid it, right, if at all possible, right? And we talked a little bit yesterday about, for my guys, what cases that might be, how do you know, right, what makes a loophole legitimate, right? But therefore, the poskim really cared about this question, which was, when the Torah said the daughters don't inherit, did they mean, when there are sons, does that mean, like, a principled position? Don't give the daughters for whatever reason, or whatever. Now, there are two questions you really have to tackle to figure this out. One is, why did the Torah say sons get and not daughters, bring the local question. And then there's a slightly broader conceptual question, which, for my guys, we'll deal more in depth tomorrow, but, or whenever we finish this, which is a broader question about Yerusha itself, right? That there are two ways to really think about the mitzvah of Yerusha, right? So, again, my guys, what's weird about the psukim by Yerusha? What does it sound like? Yes, Rami?
Oh, well, I mean, doesn't actually explicitly say, like, that sons inherit.
Right, I mean, the Torah never says, in an active sense, right, follow the laws of Yerusha. It says, if there's no son, then it goes to daughters. But never says sons get, right? That's like taken as a given, right? That's, right, the Torah never says sons inherit. It just says if there's no sons, then daughter inherit. And by implication, you know that sons inherit, which leads people to ask, what exactly is the nature of the mitzvah of Yerusha? So what might be the nature of the mitzvah of Yerusha?
Just like whatever society says.
Right, meaning it might just be, or put it differently, right? It might just be the Torah saying, look, there's an order that you're supposed to follow as a default. It's not a mitzvah, right, per se. It's not an active mitzvah. It's a protocol, right? To take a radical case where there is no machloket about, but it's a good paradigm, the Torah says that if I lend Avi my... What am I lending you, Avi?
Oh, your car.
My car. Okay, so if I lend Avi my hypothetical car, yeah, if I hypothetically lend Avi my actual car, right, then what's the halakha? If something happens to the car, is Avi responsible? So what's the normal rules? So it depends. If he's a shoel, he just borrowed it, meaning Avi didn't pay me for it, right? I didn't pay him to watch it. He just borrowed it. So Avi gets all the advantages. He's called a shoel. He's just a borrower. So then Avi is responsible for almost anything that happens to it, right? Right? He's responsible if it's stolen. He's responsible if it gets damaged. He's responsible, definitely responsible if he's posheya, right? Let's say it flipped. It wasn't that I lent it to Avi. I said, Avi, can you do me a favor and watch my car, right? So now he's a shomer chinam. He doesn't get to use it. He's just watching it on my behalf, and I'm not paying him anything. So now, Avi is responsible for very minimal things. He's only responsible for poshea. He's only responsible if he's negligent. But if it gets stolen, it's not Avi's problem. Right? But what happens if I say to Avi, Avi, can you do me a favor and watch my car? And Avi so graciously says, of course. And then Avi says, and you know, Rabbi Hearing, I like you so much that even though you're not paying me anything, I take extra responsibility on me. And if anything happens to the car, even through no fault of my own, right, I'll pay for it. Is that halakhically binding?
Yes.
Right? That goes against the laws of the Torah, because the Shomer Chinam doesn't hold those laws of responsibility. So what's the answer? Yes. So why is that true? Bava Mekama and Bava Metzia, right? Why is that true? Because the Torah set a default. The Torah doesn't care. You can make whatever deal you want. Right? If Avi decides to accept more responsibility, that's fine. So that's exactly the point. You're actually a Shomer Chinam with higher level responsibility. And the same is true that I could say, I really like you, Avi. You can borrow my car, and I don't care no matter what happens to it, I won't hold you responsible because I trust you so much. I like you so much. It doesn't matter what happens. If it happens, okay. You know, it's not your fault, or I'm not going to hold you responsible. He's a shoel without the responsibilities of a shoel. Well, you can do that. Because the Torah doesn't have, like, a vested interest in following the laws of Shomrim. It sets a default, right? But it's not an active mitzvah. You don't have to do that. It's just the Torah's default. You choose not to, that's fine. There are other mitzvot that are not like that, like Shabbos, right? The Torah didn't say, well, you know, keep Shabbos unless you don't want to. If you choose to celebrate Shabbos by lighting fires all day, so that's also fine, right? The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah tells you what to do, and you have to do that. The question is, where does Yerusha fall? Right? Is Yerusha a default, right? In which case, it's fundamentally legitimate to find, right now it's not quite a default in the way Shomrim is, where all it takes for you to circumvent it is to make a deal. Right? It's clearly more than that, and we've got to figure out exactly what it is. But is it more like that? Meaning it's more just a default that the Torah says, this is what happens, and but if you want to figure out a way to do it, it doesn't, right? The Torah doesn't have a vested interest in changing, in not changing it. It's just, it is the default, right? You just need to find the right mechanism to circumvent it. Or do you say, no, it's a mitzvah, right? Yerusha is a mitzvah, and therefore it's wrong to try to undermine the order that the Torah set up. Right? Now this became important for Yerusha Bat, because this was the meta question, or the meta questions that Poskim were dealing with, and they were trying to figure out what should we find mechanisms, and there are a lot of them, right? And I'll throw them out there. Now one is one which is hundreds of years old, called the Shtar Chatzi Zachar, which is a document that functionally gives the daughter half the portion of a son, which eventually, in some poskim, morphed. The same mechanism became a shtar kulo zachar. The mechanism used is very fancy. It creates artificial debt. Right? It goes like this, right? I declare that I owe my daughter $1 million. So now, when I die, not hypothetically, what right? That will happen one day. Hopefully in a long time, but one day, right? I say that, look, so who has to pay that debt when I die? What? My estate. Who inherits my estate? My sons. So that means presumably I'm not going to be worth $1 million unless there's hyperinflation, right? So functionally, my daughter, my sons would have to give my entire inheritance, their entire inheritance to my daughter, right? But I put a clause in it and say that my daughter agrees to waive her right to the debt on condition that they give her a percentage of my estate, which is parallel to that which the sons get, right? That's one mechanism that is used, right? It's to create artificial debt, to create this functional equivalent called the Shtar Chatzi Zachar, Her Chuluz Zachar, right? There are other mechanisms. There were many poskim who thought that Dina de Malchuta worked, that simply the fact that the government law is different is enough. Major poskim thought this. Other major poskim hated this with a deep passion. There were big names on that, like Ramosha Feinstein, who thought that it worked. Rabbi Soloveitchik, right? There were big names who thought that it worked, apparently, but still is not the dominant view. In poskim, there's something called an in vivos trust, which might work. There are all types of interesting mechanisms that might or might not work, and to different extents. But again, the prior question is that the right thing to do, or is it spiritually wrong? Yes, yes.
It can't be. Could be a case where the Torah wants a certain thing, mitzvah, like it doesn't. And the Shiv's always done that. For example, say the Torah wants us to keep plans intact, but that shit failed with Gala Saucer, so it's just, it doesn't matter.
Sure, you could say that maybe, right, meaning you can obviously have a hybrid position, right, or a middle position, that in the time of the ideal Torah world, it would have been whatever, but we live in a B'dievet situation, so we deal with B'dievet. Of course you could do that, right? You can always do that, right? Meaning, right, there's, right, one of my Rebbeim used to say, right, there's two types of B'dievets, right? There's B'dievet, like in this situation, this is not ideal, but because they're extenuating circumstances, we do it anyways. And then there's like systematic b'dievets, right? Like we wish we weren't in this situation, right? But like we're always in this situation, right? And therefore the world is not ideal, so everything we do is basically b'dievet, right? But practically that has no ramifications. There's no way of avoiding that, right? So yeah, you could say something like that if you wanted, right? I don't know what you would say, but you could. Sure, Avi, yeah.
My question is, convoluted means of $1 million official debt and percent. Why not just say like a 17% straight to the daughter?
Because you daughters don't inherit.
But it's just more than an official debt of 17%.
He's saying, why say you owe $1 million?
Why go from a million down to
because you want, I mean, you could, theoretically, right? They do this in order to make it that the son, whatever, you could do it however you want, right? The reason they don't do that is, right, because, right, once you do this, basically you've assured it to work no matter how many kids you have in the future and things like that, right? Right, meaning if you have five kids, right, so you divide it 20%, but then you have a sixth kid, right? You got
to
do this again. Yeah, I understand. Right? So, whatever. You could. There are different ways of doing it. It doesn't have to be $1 million. It can be however you want. Right? But this is the way they do it. Okay? There are different mechanisms. Right? And again, but like I said, the prior question before you figure out the mechanisms is to figure out, well, should I use them? Okay? So, guys not in my share now. How many of you got a chance to look at the Gemara and Shabbos and the Gemara and Bava Basra? Just to summarize it. Yeah.
The first one?
Yeah, Kuftes Vav. Yeah, okay, good. So, Andrew, tell me, what happened in the Gemara in Bava Basra Kuftes Vav, and what might it tell us about this quiz?
It was a case about, like, trying to, they were, the wife of one of the rabbis wanted to get this land for herself.
So not the one in Shabbat. You're talking about the Gemara in Shabbat?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So start with the Gemara in Shabbat. Right, fine. Just tell me what happened in the story in Shabbat. Ima Shalom and Re'elazar, what did they want to prove? What did they set out to prove?
He wanted to prove you could get Yerusha the land for herself.
No, she didn't want to do that. That's not what happened. That's how she used it. What did they want to prove?
Oh, that the judge was...
Yeah, they wanted to prove that the judge, who was a Suki, was a maneuver,
yeah.
Right? Accepted bribes, because he claimed he didn't.
Yeah.
The facade they used was she made a claim that she wanted to inherit.
Yeah.
Right? Good. So then what happened?
Then
first she bribed him, and he said...
He accepted it.
Right? And he said...
Men and women
inherit together.
And then she's like, no, that's not true.
Right, and then he bribed, and then he said, no, the Torah said that only boys inherit, right? And they said, aha, you're right, you accept bribes, right? Now, that Gemara becomes important because whose mouth does he put the idea in that sons and daughters inherit together? No.
No, ask the judge, evil man.
Right, no, that boys inherit, he put in the mouth of the Torah. Who did he put, in whose mouth did he put? Yes, thank you. The Christian, right, philosophy. Which means that you could look at this Gemara and say that the question, that this isn't just a localized halachic question. You could look at this Gemara and say, aha, right? The Jewish view actually believes that sons should inherit, and the idea that daughters should inherit with sons is an alien view. Right? That you could look at the Gemara that way. Or, how else might you look at this Gemara?
It was just something they did.
Yeah, like if it's all of this, there's not, you can't prove anything in Gemara. They were just trying to prove that the guy accepted bribes, and like, this is what they used, right? But you can't prove that there's a principled opposition. Okay, good. What about the Gemara and Bava Basra? I'm running through it only because my shir did it yesterday. Yeah, what about the Gemara and Bava Basra? What happens in the Gemara and Bava Basra?
Basically, or at least the second part, they fudge the rule of inheritance to make, or to prevent us from inheriting when the young is new or die, or to keep the young.
Before that, the Gemara says that anyone who says that son, right, the Gemara quotes the Stuki Machloket, that what? Daughters inherit equally to who?
To the daughters of sons.
Right, granddaughters from the son. Right, and Chazal opposes it. The reason conceptually seems to have to do with how you understand Yerusha, whether it goes directly from the, automatically from the person who's bequeathing it to the heir, or it goes through all relevant generations. Right? If it goes directly, then yes, a daughter is closer than a granddaughter. But if it goes through all relevant generations, then it first went to the son, right, and then passed to his daughter, right? And therefore, since sons go first, the son goes first. Right? That seems to be the conceptual, but that's a different story. That's the question of mishmush, of what's called mishmush or Yerusha Bakefer. Okay? But the Gemara says that the Tzdukim believe that daughters are as closely related as granddaughters, and we, in principle, don't. Right? So, what do you derive from that? Right? So again, you could just say it's a localized machloket about does Yerusha pass directly to the heir or through all relevant heirs, and therefore this is, right, and it's Yerusha machloket. Or you could say, no, you see that the Tzuki view here moves closer towards equality than ours, and the fact that we reject that, right, represents something about our philosophy. Right? Similarly, the end of that Gemara, which says anyone who dies without sons, it shows that God is angry at you, right? Why is that the case, right? Is it because, like, Yerusha going to daughters is, like, unnatural, right? Or is it simply if someone dies without sons, it shows God is angry? It doesn't tell you that, right, we have, like, an opposition to daughters. It's just, like, it means that if someone didn't manage to have sons, that sure reveals God is angry. It doesn't tell us anything about Yerusha. Right? So each of these Gemaras, you have to ask the question. So Rav Kook took the position, right, based on these Gemaras, that what? What was Rav Kook's position about whether daughters should inherit? Yeah, Rami. Bleh. Thank you. That was very specific. Yeah. Rav Kook's a little bit more articulate. Rav Kook takes the view, he takes in each of these cases the view that it's not just the Torah says that daughters don't inherit when there are sons, the Torah is opposed to it. And claiming that daughters should inherit when there are sons in because you believe in justice and equality is the corruption of your mind away from truth. And right? He's quite harsh, right? And he just says, right, Kol chok u'mishpat shebo olam le'malei le'olam et kol ha'dei yishot shel kol ha'pratim. No law will ever be good for everybody. Law by their design is meant for most people most times, but it will be bad for some people and sometimes. Where does he get that from? The Rambam and Mar Nevuchim in Chel Gimel, Perek Lama Dalet, thank you. Right? Where the Rambam says that law is not good for everybody, including Torah law. It's good for most people at most times, but there are people in this world for whom the Torah is bad. Too bad. Just deal with it. Right? That's just built into the nature of law. Then he says about those people who try to give Yerusha two daughters. What does he say? They are corrupting the system. And he says, Oila, if you go down three lines, Oila lekalot dat, shetishlach yadav v'makom ram v'nisa behechal ha-mishpat, right? Woe to those who are of flighty of mind, who are trying to destroy the Beit HaMikdash, essentially. Even if their motivation is justice, right? And what is right in this world. That mercy that takes inheritance away from the son, which he got by right of the Torah, just because you have mercy on the daughters, right? You're basically challenging God's mercy. Right? God is the one who divvies up all assets in the world. If he said this is the wrong thing to do, and you think it's the right thing to do, well, you are wrong. Right? You are corrupt. Right? It's terrible. I got into a dispute with Rice Sklar about this yesterday where he did not remember Rav Kook the way I did. I still think I'm right, and I read him the piece that I think of Rav Kook. Rav Kook, you know, in the context of women voting, right? For all Rav Kook is known as a liberal and whatever, right, and tolerant, Rav Kook thought that women were not allowed to vote because letting women vote was an encroachment of external values that was destroying the family unit, because allowing women to have opinions and express them in the vote will destroy the family. You need a unified family. Till the day he died, he opposed this. He surprised the people who asked him, who thought that, you know, he was like the all tolerant or whatever, and he would be okay with it. He was not. But Rav Kook says that this is a fundamental corruption of the Torah. The Torah wants sons to inherit and not daughters. Why? I don't know. Right? But daughters are a last resort. But when there are sons, sons inherit. Daughters do not. Actively. It's the wrong thing to do. And finding a mechanism to let them inherit is wrong. Okay, now for my guys, we're now picking up where we were yesterday. Methodologically, if you wanted to argue under Rav Kook, what do you need to do? What do you need to prove? What's at stake? Right, what do you need to prove? Or how do you go about proving it? What do you need to do? Right? Yes, I know, for a Ginsburg chair, there's a different way of thinking. But this is not a local Lumdish question. Right? This is a broad methodological question. Right? Rav Kook is not making a local argument. He's saying the system as a whole opposes this happening, and therefore, even if you could find a legal mechanism to make daughters inherit, it's the wrong thing to do. Because the Torah's belief that sons inherit and not daughters is fundamental, not accidental, as proved from these Agadotot that put the idea of equality of inheritance in the mouth of anti-halachic voices. So methodologically, if you don't want to just, right, this is not a local Lumdish machlokas. Right? This is a broad claim about the system and about the religious legitimacy of using loopholes that technically work. Right? This is a meta question. Right? How do you go about answering that? What do you look for?
Parallel case.
So you could look at a parallel case. What would a parallel case mean?
That we don't say things as far as being like a broader question. That we can find then other cases where we don't get these prizes.
But as I said, I can find you cases in both directions. How do I go about proving this? I said you could analogize to Shomrim, where the Torah doesn't care what you do, right? It just sets a default. Or I can analogize to Shabbat, right? Right? Sure, I find a parallel case, but how do you know? What's parallel, right? What are you doing methodologically, Shmuel?
Oh, I was going to bring up a specific parallel case, but I think that's...
Methodologically speaking, first, what do you do? Then I'll take your specific example. What do you do?
Yeah, we go back to the last show of the shot.
Okay, so one possibility is you locally go back to the Torah and figure out, does it sound like the Torah is giving a default, or does it sound like the Torah is making a value judgment? Right? 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 Because if you're making a claim about the system, so one way is to basically look for textual, philosophical cues. Now, you could do that in the Psukim, as Shmuel says, you could do it in the Agadatot, you could do it, right? But one way is to look for philosophical statements that will indicate that this is a default rather than a principal decision. Okay, Yaakov.
You go to the cases that Brett Mara has explained how they don't necessarily show that it's
Mara. So Yaakov does an interesting thing, right? And I want to point out the difference in what they did. Shmuel says you go to the Psukim or the Gemara, whatever, and you find indications that positively point in a direction, right? That the Torah doesn't oppose this. The Torah is okay with this. Right? Yaakov said, you don't necessarily have to go that far. Right? What else can you do? You can simply negate counterproofs. Now, why? But if you negate counterproofs, so what are you left with methodologically?
Nothing.
Nothing. Good. So if you're left with nothing, then what?
Okay.
So you can either be arbitrary or, right, what might drive you? I know this is a very offensive thing to say, but right, what might drive you if what you're convinced in the sugya is that it's completely ambiguous and you have no evidence, lakan or lakan? Meaning, that's exactly the point, is that if you're left with nothing, if you're convinced that the sugya is ambiguous, right, and you can't prove it here, right, you can either try, like Shmuel is doing, which is to say, I think the Torah actively means X, right, or some people are going to be comfortable and some people are going to be radically uncomfortable with this, which is to say, no, get to the point of ambiguity where the Torah, you don't know what the Torah says, and since you're at an impasse, import your own values because you're not sure what the Torah says, and that will tip you, right? So Shmuel says that's absolutely a sur, and I'm sure Rabbi Ginsburg, if I even raise this, would, right, you know, not be happy with me raising that possibility, right? But obviously, methodologically, that's an approach. Right? Meaning, obviously, if you're actually convinced the Torah is neutral on something, right, or you can't tell, so then why shouldn't you take your values, wherever they come from, to sway you, right? Now, if you think there's something fundamentally with having an opinion that is not directly grounded in Torah, then sure, I understand, right, why you would do this. But if you don't believe that, right, if you think that there's legitimacy to having opinions, you just have to be in conversation with the Torah, then that might not be illegitimate. Okay? I make that point because it's a broader point. It's not true of Yerusha. Right? Now, Shmuel thinks that even that methodological suggestion is heretical. Yeah, go ahead. The Chazon Ish for sure thought what I just said is heresy. I'm not denying the Chazon Ish thought it was heresy. Right? But the Chazon Ish is not the only view. Right? I understand. We will see that the Chazon Ish thinks that's heresy. There's a reason he hated what we're about to see from Herzog, and I gave you the Chazon Ish. Sure. But you just name-dropped. You didn't give me an argument. You name-dropped that the Chazon Ish thinks that it's usur. I agree. That's descriptive. The Chazon Ish didn't like what I just said. Okay. I got that. I know. He's not the only voice, though.
All right. So which Rabban has said we can import our own doubt?
Well, let's see. Just the guys that we've seen this year and my share. So the Dor Revi'i, in his introduction to Chulin, says that it's important to use natural morality. That's a factor in halakha. What? I think we saw it from the door of V.E., right? So I'm just trying to go through people we've seen. But yeah, of course you can give, right? Of course you can give names of people who care, who think that you're allowed to do that. What? Well, Rav Amital is finding the door of V.E. for sure. Rav Amital went in that direction. Sure, but many people went in that direction, right? Many people thought, many non-Bristers think that that's a legitimate thing to do, right? Right? Many non-Bristers think that that's a legitimate thing to do.
Many Bristers think it's an illegitimate thing to do.
Yes, I know. That was the implication of what I just said, right? Yes, I got that. I got that. I know that. I'm aware. Trust me, I'm aware, right? I'm aware. I've had this discussion with Ginsburg before. I don't fall on the same side on this question, shall we say, right? Bimikre. In a Chanami. But, look, I'm going to say something heretical, right? But it's almost definitely the case that the Rambam disagreed with that claim. Remember, the Rambam thinks that the highest level of Torah are those things that are not in the Torah, right? Remember, his ultimate, Maaseh Merkava, he finds not in any rabbinic literature because he thinks we've lost it, right? And he finds it in Aristotle, right? Right?
We find it in Aristotle, but not in
right? I'm saying, in the end of the day, the Rambam thinks that the most important things in life he finds external to the text of Torah, right? So, to look at the Rambam and think he thinks that all your views have to come from Torah when clearly he does not, right? Right? Which is why, by the way, right, the Rav in the fourth section of Halachic Mind says everything the Rambam did in Mor Nevuchim Matami HaMitzvot is wrong. It's all wrong. It's all worthless, right? The only time he got it right was when he wasn't trying to do philosophy. When he's trying to do halacha, he got philosophy right. When he tried to do philosophy, he was just wrong because everything he did in Matami HaMitzvot was taking things from outside the Torah and importing them into the Torah. So the Rav's assessment of the Rambam was that this was the Rambam's approach to all of Matami HaMitzvot, right? Take it or leave it, right? That's what he thought he was doing, right? So if you agree with the Rav, then the name on the other side of the equation is the Rambam. So, I don't know. Take it, right? Okay? I don't know what to tell you, right? Yes, Joseph.
The lack of arguments for there being as a reason or a mitzvah behind Torah is going to be itself an argument that's default.
Say that again?
Where if you were to argue that, like, this particular mitzvah...
Oh, sure. You could have a very clever argument, which is the fact that the Torah seems to be ambiguous might just show it's a default. Right? Meaning it might just tell you the Torah is neutral on it. Right? Yes, you could do that. Right? Of course. That goes more, I think, in Shmuel's direction. Right? Which is to say, let's see what the Torah says, but you're just adding a step to it, which is if the Torah seems to be ambiguous, maybe that's not ambiguity as much as it is neutrality. Like a principled neutrality. Right? Which is fine. That's a perfectly fine, right, methodological move, which is to say that ambiguity implies neutrality rather than ambiguity. Right? Those aren't the same. Right? Ambiguity can mean, like, ambiguous. Like, it might mean X or might mean Y, right? Neutrality means, no, I think the fact that it's ambiguous actively implies that this is more like Shomrim, where it's clearly more value neutral. Right? That's fine. You can do that. Right? This is just methodologically speaking. Yes? Okay. But there's another way to do this, which is, we're now talking on the level of philosophy, exegesis, and the like. But there's another place to go, and that is, right, where else might you go? Halacha, right? Halacha. I mean, one way is to argue philosophically, right, from philosophical texts. We can also look at halacha, right, which might imply, right, if you have other halachos, not like what David said, cognate cases, but cases that seem to belong to this world in which Chazal, let's say, or anyone you trust, right, as being a bearer of the tradition, already seems to try to undermine the black and white, right, sons everything, daughters nothing, right? If you trust Chazal to channel the spirit of the Torah, so then, if their laws themselves seem to be less antithetical to giving daughters Yerusha, then you will have proof from Chazal that they don't think it's a principled position. But what if they do? Right, but what if they do? It's not? But no, but it's not darshaning out. It's if you think Chazal, when Chazal utilized mechanisms that seem like loopholes, that's evidence that Chazal think that's not problematic, right? It's not they're darshaning it out, right? It's that you can derive from the implications of what they did legally, right? So the champion of this position was Rav Herzog. Okay? So a little bit here. This is important to understand. I said it at Parsha, I would present it, so I'll give you the short version of it. So Rav Herzog, Rav Yitzchak Levi Herzog, who was he? First Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel. Okay? That was not Rav Kook. I know people think it was Rav Kook. Rav Kook died before there was a state, right? He was chief rabbi of the mandate, but not of the state. What?
He was the chief rabbi.
Right, he was the chief rabbi of Mandate Palestine, but Rav Herzog was the first chief rabbi of the state. In Rav Herzog, there are basically, amongst religious Zionists, there were basically two main views of what place, if you want to bring Torah into Israeli law, what is the right way to do that? Okay? One view, which became very popular, was the school of Mishpat Ivri. Mishpat Ivri is a group of scholars that basically their philosophy is the more Torah I can smuggle into Israeli law, the more Jewish it is, the better. Okay? And therefore, they piecemeal go mitzvah by mitzvah and say, okay, what can I do? What can Torah tell us about this law? Right? And therefore, you will find interesting cases, because in Israel, Mishpat Ivri is one of the legitimate sources of law, you will find that in libel law discussions, judges will quote the Chafetz Chaim, because they are importing, right, some halacha. That's one view. But then there was another view, which basically felt like that doesn't work. Right? Rav Herzog was the father of a very different idea, which was, look, the Torah is a holistic system. And therefore, it makes sense if it works together. But you can't just have one system and like every so often pepper it with Jewishness, right? That's not how law works, right? Law is a holistic system. And therefore, if you want it to, in order to make halacha work, it needs to be complete. Now, what was the problem of Herzog faced? What? Well, secular law doesn't necessarily bother him. There was a bigger problem he faced. Some of halacha is hard to implement in modern society, and a bigger problem was that it's not impossible. Yes, okay, that's a quantitatively bigger problem. Yeah, I got that. No, there's an even more fundamental problem for him was that halacha, as we have it, was not developed in a situation in which we have a state, and therefore there's a lot of places where halacha is just silent. Right? It's just silent. Most political questions, most economic questions, right? Like, halakha wasn't developed in...
relatively modern stuff.
Like, things that are relevant in a modern state, halakha is just silent on. Right? Because halakha wasn't written by people who were living in that reality.
I mean, the original...
Correct, but a lot of that hasn't been developed in thousands of years. And therefore, we have... Right? So, Rav Herzog felt that in order to make the state work... you needed to not be afraid to make takanot. You needed to, if you wanted to have a system that worked, you need to make it holistic. In order to make it holistic, you needed to set up enough decrees that halacha could deal with a modern state. To that end, he wrote three volumes. I mean, his book is like 9 volumes, but 3 of them are called Tichukah Yisrael Al Pi Torah, which are a list of the, which is his explanation of the legitimacy of making decrees and all his suggestions for decrees. This is just volume 2 of that.
But that's how halakha was developed in many ways in the first place. Like, it's just a bunch of folks keep making halakha.
Yeah, of course. That's exactly his point, is that that was what happened when there was a Sanhedrin. We don't have it, but we haven't been in that legislative capacity for a long time. And if we want to make Torah work in the modern state, we need to do that again. Right? Correct, but not as extensively. But you're right. Right? So therefore, he wrote three volumes of Tichukal Yisrael al-Pi Torah, right, which is legislation that he was suggesting. One of the main things he dealt with in volume two is inheritance law. Because he said, in a modern society, we really got to talk about this. Yerusha Habat, Yerusha Habal, right? Inheritance of, right? Mothers, right? Don't inherit. Wives don't inherit, right? Daughters don't inherit. Right? We have to deal with this. He also has on Eidut, right? Because if you follow Torah, so then women can't be witnesses and non-Jews who live in Israel can't be witnesses. And this could be problematic, right? So he has a series of takanot that he suggests. So one of them was his series of takanot about Yerushal Habat, where he wanted to use different mechanisms, again, before we get into what the mechanisms are, in order to make it the daughters could functionally inherit. Some of them were classic ones, right? Things like the Shtar Chatzi Zacha, which is already quoted in the Ramah, plus a series of takanot that were true amongst the Jews of Morocco, right? Some were new. He has, just in this book, I think it's four chapters on different aspects of Yerushal Habat. But before he dealt with the local ones, he wanted to deal with the meta question, which is this wrong? Okay? So, he presents two arguments for why it's not wrong. One philosophical, right? Meaning, it's a hybrid of philosophy and halacha, right? But some are straight from philosophical texts and some from halachic texts. Okay? So, let's turn to the back for a second. I'll give you an example of a philosophical piece, okay? This comes from Mitzudat David. Now, what is Mitzudat David? So if you know Mitzudat David on the Torah, on the Tanakh, right? If you're familiar with any book, then Mitzudat David is probably that one. But there's another book called Mitzudat David written by the Radbaz. Who's the Radbaz? You know, like, have you ever opened a Rambam and on the side there's the Perusha Radbaz on many Svarim? No. Of course not. Use the one volume one. It doesn't have the Radbaz, I know. Right? The Radbaz was a major 15th century authority in Egypt. Right? Very major authority. He wrote, I think it's at least 5,000 tshuvot. When you go into like the Bar Ilan Responsive Project, they have like 100,000 tshuvot, of which like 5,000 are the Rajbas, 5,000 are the Radbazes, 5,000 are the Sholem Natives, and the other 85,000 are divided amongst everybody else, right? So the Radbaz is a major, major authority. Rav David ben Zimra, or Ibn Zimra. All types of fascinating tshuvot. I love this tshuvot. They're very nechmad, right? Some of them are weird. Okay. You know, there's all types of fun things, right? He's the earliest source we have in halachic literature about marijuana. Right? It's a very... all sorts of gems if you read through all 5,000 tshuvot. What? So it's weird. It comes up in the context of kilayim. And at the end of a tshuva about kilayim, he was asking whether hemp is problem of kilayim. In the end, he said, and I hear that in Egypt they smoke this to make them happy. And that's like the end of the tshuva. Right? Like, it's a very weird tshuva. Like, very, very strange. There's a lot of interesting things going on in the Radbaz. My favorite tshuva of the Radbaz is about Nizirut Shimshon, which is a wonderful tshuva, where he was asked, someone came in and said, I got angry, so I declared myself a Nazir Shimshon, which is a Nazir forever that you can never undo. What? Yeah, it's a fascinating category. And then, right, the Radbaz does the whole thing, and he said, and someone asked him, why did you do that? And he said, because that's what everybody does. And he's like, wait a second. Do you know who Shimshon is? He says, no, I have no idea who Shimshon is. So he says, I was matir because he's an idiot. Right? Like, right? The Rabbis Shuvah are wonderful. I love the Rabbis Shuvah. So the Rabbis also did a sefer HaMitzvot called Mitzudat David, which I did not know until last week, when Refertzak quoted it, and Ray Ginsburg also didn't know, Rishmal David also didn't know. We're like, oh, who knew that the Rabbis had an important book, a sefer HaMitzvot? Rabbis is very important. So, in Mitzvah Daf Kuf Lamed on Yerusha, he writes as follows. Okay? So look first on the right-hand side. He says about 10 lines down, let's say, no, like 8 lines down. Tam mitzvah zo lefi apshat mevu'ar sheyakuma ben tachar aviv lenachala kedei shelo tisov nachala mimishpacha lemishpacha. The reason for the mitzvah of Yerusha in general is so that a son will take the place of his father, so that the Yerusha, the Nachal, doesn't go from family to family. All descendants of the son come first. And because the rabbis saw that daughters don't inherit, so they made a decree of Isur Nichtei, right? That they get a tenth of the property as a dowry. Okay? And we'll see that halacha in just a second. Klala de milta, he mitzvah sichlit. This mitzvah is just logical. And all cultures have some sort of inheritance law. Everyone has laws. What laws? Whatever. Right? They all have different laws. Now skip to the second side, to the bottom. From Chachmei HaGoyim. Got it?
Yeah.
Bottom of the left-hand column, right? Like 10 lines up. Chachmei HaGoyim, the non-Jews say about us, Tov Simalenu, they yell at us. They're angry at us. Echa Shar Shalo Risha Torah Klum Labat. What is wrong with your Torah that doesn't give Yerusha to daughters? Va'ani Ragil La'ashiv Lahem, and I tell them, Shatorah Yardal L'Sof Dat Yisrael HaRachmanim, because the Torah understood that people, Jews, were merciful. And the daughters will take care of her. And the daughters will give her money. And the daughters will give her what she needs so she can get married. What? The sons. And there's other Kabbalistic reasons as well. Okay? Sharei HaShefa. Me'aba ilahu yorid al banim ascharim, because don't ask me what this means, right? But the shefa, the divine effluence, right, goes from father to son, yada, yada, yada. Okay? Rav Herzog points to this red baz, and he says, What do you learn from this red baz? Right, the red baz explicitly takes on the question, why don't daughters inherit? And what's his answer? His answer is, because they were going to get property inevitably anyways, right? The sons were going to take care of them, right? We're going to give them property, and they never didn't need them to inherit. So you'll say, then why didn't the judges give them an actual inheritance? What's his answer? So either it's Kabbalistic, right? Because only the son continues the spirit of the father, or what he said on the first side, which is, Yerusha is fundamentally a rational mitzvah, and why did it go to sons and not daughters?
Oh, because women can't
own property. No, to make sure inheritance stays in the family. But if you let daughters inherit, as we know from the case of Menot Balchad, right, very quickly inheritance gets mixed up between shvatim. So you need to choose only one side as the default, right, to minimize the amount that things go from shevet to shevet. And therefore, the Radbaz tells you, look, basically the Torah has no opposition because it's just a mitzvah sechlit. Everyone does what they want. We prefer that only sons get it because that will ensure that Yerusha, meaning land, stays within the right place, right, and doesn't keep switching shvatim. And don't worry so much about daughters not being supported because functionally they will be supported. We just don't call it Yerusha. Right? That's what the Radbaz says. Right? And then he adds one more point. And the Radbaz says, but since daughters don't inherit, what did Chazal do? They gave them the functional inheritance, the equivalent of inheritance called Isur Nichtei, right, which is a tenth of the estate, up to a tenth of the estate for a dowry, right, and that is okay. So what does the Radbaz do? The Radbaz does two things for you. One is he tells you, we're not philosophically opposed to daughters getting Yerusha, right? We just didn't think it was necessary in the economic system that it was prevalent in the time of the Torah, where primarily what you're talking about is land, which you don't want to move shevet to shevet. And in terms of practical support, they were going to get it anyways because people were just going to support them because they're nice. And point two, as he said, because fundamentally the Torah does want them to be supported, We have takanot that are the functional equivalent in the time of Chazal of inheritance. Right? So he makes two important moves. One is he tells you the Torah is not just not opposed, but it's actually in favor of girls somehow getting some of their father's property. Right? It's just that the Torah didn't want it to work through a mechanism of Yerusha. And the second is that Chazal took that a step farther and actually implemented that in law. Right? His proof text is, if you go back to the first side, the Gemara in Ksubot Daf Nun Bet, this is where he gets it from, where the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, Lo katav la binin dichrin, dehavi l'chiminai, inun yartin ketzev ktubateich, yeter al chukehen di'im achuhon, chayav shu t'nai beit din. There's something called Ksubat binin dichrin. What's Ksubat binin dichrin? Or in Hebrew, it's Ktubat banim zecharim. Right? Exact same words. Right? The ketubah of sons. What's the ketubah of sons? It's what he just said. There's a tanai baked in, an objective tanai that goes like this. The dowry goes not to all the yershim equally, but if the wife's father puts a dowry into the marriage, that money is given to the sons of that wife. So if a man has multiple wives, and one of them had $1 million dowry, one of them had $100,000 dowry, so first the money and the dowry is divided amongst the sons of the wives, and then the remainder of the estate is divided equally amongst the sons.
What remainder?
Whatever. Right, after you've given out to the sons of the wife the money that came from her dowry, right, the rest of the money that the guy who died had that wasn't from the dowries, is then divided by the normal rules of Yerusha. Right? That's called Ketubat Binin Dichrin. Right? The built-in the Ketubah is the notion that the sons of a woman inherit, right, first take, divide up what she has from her dowry, before, and that's not equally divided by all sons of the father. Okay? And even if he doesn't write it, it's automatic. It's called, right, it's Tanai Beit Din. Furthermore, binun dukvan de havi li chayminai, another tanai in the ketubah, is your daughters. Yahavun yatvin beveitiu mitzanin minichsai ad tilakchun leguvrin chayav. That until they get married, are supported from the estate. It's another tanai ketubah. Right? That the daughters, until they get married, are supported by the estate. Shehu tanai beit din. That a widow is allowed to be supported until she gets married, remarried from the estate, also tonight Beit Din. And kachayu anti Yerushalayim kodvin, anti Yerushalayim, anti Yudayim kodvin, anti Yerushin, l'tin l'chtuba u'lech. And then it says some differences in different, in geographic regions on that last point. If you then go to the Gemara says, Amar of Yochan Mishim Roshim Ban Yochai, Mipnei ma hitkinu ktubat binin dechrin. Why did we institute ktubat binin dechrin? Kedei sheikpot adam v'yichtov levito kivno, to encourage fathers to write dowries, but not just any dowries. What does the Gemara say? Levito kivno. To encourage fathers to give their daughters like they would to their sons. Sons through inheritance, daughters through dowry. Why did fathers not want to give dowries? Because they didn't want their son-in-law's other wife's kids to inherit the dowry. Right? So therefore, to encourage people to give money that would functionally go to their daughter, they kept it with, right, Chazal made a takana that it goes to the wife's sons and not the husband's other children. Right? Umi ika midi derachmana, and then the Gemara says, Umi ika midi derachmana amar bra li rush barta lo te rush. I don't understand. The Torah said that sons should inherit and daughters should not. Va'atu rabbanan umitakne de tirut barta, and the rabbi should come and say, no, daughters inherit? So the Gemara says, ma pitam. Hanami del right to who? The Torah also values giving the money to the daughters. Why? You're obligated to make sure your daughter gets married. And part of that, definitely in the ancient world, was providing a dowry and support. So he says, Bishlom abanim biyadei kaimei. So my sons, I can marry off. El bintei mi kaimen biyadei. How do I marry off daughters? What do you do? Answer, hakamashmon, denomination, nechseseh v'netiv b'midei. You give them clothes, you give them, right? And you give them a dowry. And that is how you accomplish it. Kihichi dekavtsiya lava atu v'nezvila. And then people will come and marry you. Va'ad kama, how much? A bayi rabbi, don't go on. Israel and nechseh, up to 10% of the estate. So then, the Gemara skipping down says, well, why don't you do this with, right, you know, let's keep reading. The Gemara says, Ve'ema da'av liro da'balo lo liro, imkein avnami minna ve'lo katav. He says, so maybe the father should inherit, not the husband. He said, no, the father won't write it. Ve'ema heichet katav av licht of baal, heichet lo katav av lo licht of baal, lo plug rabbanon. Fine, it's a lo plug. But ben abonim nami teirot, the Gemara says, once you're saying that, then shouldn't daughters just straight inherit? Right? No, kenachla shavu rabbanan. You can't directly give it to the girls because we treat this like Yerusha, and daughters don't technically inherit. So bat ben abanot tirot. So what about if they're only girls? So then what do? Then you shouldn't have this rule because they're actually getting property. So you don't need to, low plug rabbanan. Don't worry about that low plug. V'tigvei mitaltle. Why don't you take from mitaltle? And kiktuba shavu rabbanan. It's like a ktuba. And ksubas don't come from a taltlin, from chattel. Titcher of Mimi Shabdai, so why don't they take it even from Mishubadim, from land with liens on it? No, Yartun Tanan, we treat it like Yerusha. Fine, Ve'ema Avagav Deleka Motar Dinar. How do you know that you might have thought that you do this even if there's nothing left for the sons? No, because B'makom to Mi'akra Nachla Doraita Lo Takina Rabbanan. We don't institute this when it totally uproots Nachla Midoraita. If Herzog looks at this Gemara, what does he see? What does he see? He says, Chazal were aware of this. Chazal actually explicitly said this, which is, oh, the Torah says daughters don't inherit. And what is the Gemara answer? You're right. They don't formally inherit. But there are counter values that say that functionally you should give something to your daughters. Because you want them to be taken care of. You want them to be able to get married. Right? That requires an investment. Right? Which means that not only did the Gemara not oppose it philosophically. The Gemara even asks the question explicitly and says, what are you doing? Didn't the Torah say the daughters don't inherit? What is the Gemara's answer, both hashkafically and halachically? They don't inherit, but they are supported in ways that can be functionally equivalent to inheritance, and that's also part of the Torah's vision. So then you'll ask me, oh, then why didn't they just inherit straight? So that probably goes back to what the Radbaz said, that because the primary inheritance in the time of the Torah is land, and one of the overarching values in the Torah is that tribal inheritance stays stable, right? So formal inheritance, which applied to land, so the Torah, we limited it, right, to sons, or something like that, right? But if that's the case, then let's say you live in a world in which what? Right, in which land is not as important, right, in which we live in a cash economy, right, or whatever, not cash, but we don't necessarily, right, land is not the only thing that's valuable, right, and we're not even dealing with ancestral land, right, so our Yerusha looks a lot more like support than passing on the ancestral lands, so then again, we can't formally give girls Yerusha because that's not what the Torah says, right? But there's nothing wrong with us channeling the same thing Chazal did, which is functionally giving them some sort of Yerusha. How much? Different question. Right? So this is what Rav Herzog basically argues throughout his chapter in Yerusha Bat. Let me just read Rav Herzog. At the end of his first piece on Yerusha Bat, he summarizes this, and he says, "V'inyan Yerusha Rabat, when it comes to the inheritance of a daughter, hinei kvar rabotin achronei achronim, maskirim shu tra ritu ha-shabat tiresh b'shavem achem." And he said, it's not just me. There's hundreds of years of rabbinic precedent that we use shtar chatzi zachar, shtar kulo zachar, that we treat daughters like sons. Kevan shekein hu b'nim esem and yirzeinam and hagla fasher b'neihem. Right? And this is the custom, and this is the deals we make. V'sachli bar samcha. And someone told me, who I rely on, ha-soferim, right? This is actually one of the, Shmuel Dev, you ever see this? He paskins l'alacha based on Agna. Right? Herzog said, I heard from Shai Agnon. Who's Shai Agnon? The poet, author, right? The only Israeli Nobel Prize winner in literature, Shai Agnon. He said, I heard from Shai Agnon. This is his psak, right? Shebegalitzia, that in Galitzia, if name is Parashanim, Bekesher li Zavon echad al-Marim Zatzal, emidu achim midim al-din taravu, patru achotam below klum. There was one of the Hasidish Rebbes that his son said, boys inherit, not girls, and they refused to give to their sisters. Vilaza alehem kol ha-medina, and every Jew in the entire country talked badly about them. Because that is not how we do things. Right? The minog is so entrenched. Everyone that is doing it wrong. Haresha hergesha klali kvar bedorahu. Already 100 years ago amongst Hasidim, who are not like the vanguard of feminism, right? Haya she'en la'amod of shurat ha'din begon zeh. Everyone understood, you don't just go by Torah law. Shekvar az lo achshir dara v'abana yisrael kod milot al kipuch hazeh. Daughter said it's unfair, and everyone agreed with them. Masha'en kain, v'dor rishonim she'en v'kablot alayin ekzir ha'tara v'aybala v'nim rivodu k'tatan v'shalcha v'sin ha'aza. Right, so he says, this is, right, it's not against the law. It's not against the spirit of the law. It's not against the law. Chazal already began this process and actualizing that philosophy into law. And therefore, it's just a question of how we do it. But it's not wrong. Right? We're channeling the exact same intuitions as Chazal when they set up Ksubas Menin Dichsen of Isser Nichsei, which is that supporting your daughters and making sure that after you die, your daughters are taken care of. Finding a mechanism to that that's not formally Yerusha is actually not just not against the Torah, it's what the Torah wants. And again, you have to explain why the Torah therefore chose not just to give daughters directly, and then either you come up with some Kabbalistic reason that formally Yerusha channels the spirit, or you say that land is different because we want, you know, land, ancestral lands to be stable, right? Come up with whatever you want. But he argues that hashkafically and halachically, the simple read of the Gemara is that Chazal did not believe that there was something formally... Now, some poskim argue and that because there's also a mitzvah of Yerusha, so you shouldn't do this for all your property, right? So I, like Ray Willig, for example, poskim, he's not the only one, but I heard it from him, says that you should leave like $1,000 of Yerusha that actually follows Torah law, right? Like... use whatever mechanisms you want, but leave at least some of your property to be totally divided along Torah lines, because that shows that, right, a certain attempt at fulfilling the mitzvah pshuto, kimashma'o, a certain relinquishing of rights, recognizing you're not fully in control, right? Some poskim don't even think that's necessary, right? That comes down to the extent to which you think is Yerusha is really a mitzvah, right, in which at least some of your property should therefore be divided up straight halachically. Right? Or do you think that, no, it's only, right, a process, it's a default, things like that, and therefore creating other mechanisms that circumvent Yerusha is not problematic, right? That's a related question, right? Ezra, Shmuel, Eli.
The issue of, like, having, like, picking the not firstborn child, or the, like...
So Bechor was another story.
Doesn't that...
So Bechor is another story here.
Right, but doesn't that issue imply a lot more level of...
Yes. Bechor is unique, right? And we're going to have to talk about it. I'm bracketing it now. Bechor, for a lot of reasons, is unique. Bechor, the Gemara already says, is unique because the Torah calls it matana, right, which implies a different level of control. You're right. It also, there's a, there, even if you think Yerusha is not a formal mitzvah, it's a default process or something like that, Bechor might be different, right? Because the psukim are framed differently than they are by, so Bechor, bracket, you're right. Bechor is different in many, many ways. Bechor, right, I know we're going through this slowly, we have to, but yes, Yerusha Bechor is a different ballgame in many ways, in terms of your control, in terms of whether there's a mitzvah component or not, yes, and that's why that's a separate chapter in Tzulcha, but it's also it's a very different subject, you're right.
And is that necessary nowadays?
Again, that's
okay, yeah, we'll
lot, yes. Maybe next, we're definitely doing it, I hope to definitely cover this year, maybe next. It is really the logical thing to move to next, which is to say, right, whatever Yerusha is, Yerusha Bechor are the same, so we might do it next. I haven't fully decided, but we might. Yeah, Shmuel.
Sorry,
guys, not my show, but yes.
I hate to throw a whole other mention here, but what's not mentioned here is the very next adapta of the Talmud, where the shot is...
In which one? In Ksubos?
Actually, then... No, it's Baba Basra.
Okay, I didn't know which, the next stop in which, yeah.
Right, it's where it says, yes, shut, where it's like, there's this clause, Yishman healing below no kali, right?
And that's the Mishnah on Kofchet.
Right, so by reading that Mishnah and to say that daughters can inherit even when there are sons.
No, they're not inheriting. They're creating the functional equivalent of inheritance.
Okay,
that's different.
Okay, but
no, 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 not granted. You keep doing this. This is exactly his point, is that Chazal, the Gemara in Ksubos, explicitly says that, which is, right, but the Torah says don't inherit. He says, you're right, but there's no problem in us functionally making them inherit because there's a value to them being supported after the father dies. Right? That's the Gemara's question in Ksubos, which is, daughters don't inherit, so why are you giving them money? Answer, you're right, but supporting them is also a Torah value, and therefore creating the functional equivalent of inheritance is not a problem. That's Rav Herzog's point, which is, you're right, they don't inherit. No one says they do. But can you create the functional equivalent? Right? That's exactly the point. Is this that daughters shouldn't get things because the fact that the Torah says they don't inherit means the Torah doesn't want them to get anything after his death? Or is it something unique to inheritance? Right? But the equivalent of it is fine. And Rav Herzog says, well, what do you think Ksuba's been in Dichron is? Right? The Gemara itself asked this question. Ellie.
My question originally, I think you answered it, but it was like, you're saying like, if you're going to go by the whole thing where you do like, so that your daughter gets it, and it's going to be your son, because they are attacked and everything, you should like leave a little bit of money on the side.
Right, and that comes down to the question, right, I think of whether you think of Yush at all as a mitzvah or just a default.
Right?
If you think there's actually a mitzvah, then at least some of it, right, you should let the Torah take its course, as it were.
Also, like, if you think that that's the correct way, then why are you doing it? Even if it's a lot like...
Well, because that's exactly what Herzog is saying. The Gemara recognized that, and the Gemara said, yes, but there are other values. There's whatever value is inherent in Yerusha, right? But there are other values that support, that push in the direction of supporting your son afterwards, and that's why we don't call it Yerusha, right? We just create the equivalent of Yerusha, right? Right, which... most people don't care whether they inherit or they get support from their father after death, right? But he says, you're right, they don't inherit, right? But Chazal already recognized that we can do the equivalent of, right? Meaning institutionalized support from the estate, right? You're right, right? Yeah.
It's a question. It was just like the value is in order to get your daughters married, so... if you live in a society where dowry is not important, would that therefore...
Good. So you could read the Gemara locally and say, the only value here is dowry, right? But or you could say, right, no, right? There's a bunch of values, meaning your daughter, I mean, part of the reason that you need dowry and part of the reason that your daughter is being married is that's the way in a world where only men work, where you're going to make sure your daughter is taken care of, right? And therefore, the way it looked like to making sure that they were financially taken care of was making sure they got married, which was a dowry. Right? Is the value here only getting them married, or is the value making sure your daughters are taken care of? Which, sure, in the ancient world, the only way to really do that was to make sure they got married. Right? Right? The question is how limited you read that Gemara. Right? And what Herzog argues is that the history of halacha tells us we read more expansively. Right? Because for hundreds and hundreds of years, we've been coming up with mechanisms to let daughters inherit. Right? And Rav Kook, and as we'll see just in a second, the Chazon Ish really go against that tradition. Right? Very quickly, I just want to look at the Chazon Ish, because what's amazing here is the Chazon Ish is responding to Rav Herzog, but how much does he actually talk about Yerusha Bat? Almost not at all, because what's his opposition? It's not the local thing. It's with Rav Herzog's belief that you should set up decrees that change what it says in Torah law. Right? He, like Rav Kook, takes this as, right, in undermining Torah values. Right, again, this is a meta machlokas. It's not a localized machlokas about Yerusha Bat. It's a machlokas of what does the Torah really want from you? So you look for the Chazon Ish, right? He says, Shalom, v'chol tov, selah l'maran shlita. If that wasn't in brackets, I don't know if anyone would have known that, right? The Rashi Tevot, Aleph Chet Dalet Shin Hey Dalet Reish Gimel, which is Acharei Drishat Shalom Hadarat Geono, right? Which is after the proper greetings to accord the honor of his genius hood, whatever. Ba'ahava rabba, with much love. That's about where the love ends, is where, with him saying it, but fine. Ritzoni bazeh lo'odia tzari ha'gadol al machshava zara al merachefet ba'avir arsinu ha'kedosha. I want to tell you about the great pain I have for these foreign thoughts that are floating over our holy land. To make decrees against the Torah as we have it in our hands. It causes a destruction of faith in the from people. Because heresy, denial of God, have increased now that we are reaching the period of the Mashiach. Newspaper articles come out every day that are just trying to lead people astray from the Rambam's Yud Gimel Karim, to teach them that there is no world to come, there's only one world, there's no God, that Jews aren't a people, the Torah isn't from heaven, everyone just follows their own heresy, right? That's, I think, a bit harsh to accuse of Herzog of, but okay. The line between heresy and belief is very thin. And emuna, like everything else, is in degrees. Yesh amatenu bri'ah, right? Some people have a healthy belief. Some people are weak in their belief, over alab lehergish, and will violate things without feeling. And it could be that even those who are really, right, Poseh al Shnei HaSifim is borrowed from Eliyahu, that you have one foot for God and one foot for Avodah Zarah, are still viewed as being inside the camp. Right, he's saying, right, you're the chief rabbi, you're very from, but you know, you basically have one foot in Torah and one foot in Avodah Zarah. Right, that's basically what he said to Herzog. Eliyahu zachor latov, going back to Eliyahu, right, etc. Next paragraph. Amnam rofim b'dorein nechneim lekofrim. Right, people who are weak, they turn to kfir of an enemy. Yisal chen b'nei akofra al cheshbon rifyon amunah. They love to make kofrim happy, even at the cost of amunah. Kinenu kanai, right, because they're not zealots. Right, right. Basically, people are more than happy to follow heresy. Dot 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 dot. Right, next page. Right, and he said, right, therefore, Ra'ul Khoma Amin Lashuva Mendo Bishamo Drishalik Viramuklaket, every time, right, you have to double down on your faith. When people say this heresy, Shayitomru, Tirasha Badin Maben. When you hear these people saying spewing heresy that daughters should inherit with sons, Kfar Lachmu Bazek Chamim Matsukim, this was the rabbis versus the Stukin. Timonenu Netamu alivavot, in our shock, the hearts have been sealed up. V'tachat kifot hadad v'emet haruach lamod kitzur natzav v'mona v'nayin k'meshpat l'lokimhu. Right? People basically don't believe that God is the one who has justice, and he goes on and on and on. Right? And therefore, the only option is l'adona to din Torah. You have to follow the Torah as it is. Right? Umilo shamar etenu k'anachin dor yatom. Don't you know that we're an orphan generation? Ve'enanu ri'uyim klal. We can't make decrees. You have to be a huge Talmud Chacham. V'anachnu yoradnu plaim v'edyodon anachnu. Right? You read the Tadoros, we're terrible, we're nothing. Ve'echna is panenu v'nakshe or penu. How can we have the audacity and stubbornness, lomar chachamim anachnu, to say that we're even wise, v'yesh koach v'yadeinu lafkir mamon, and to say that we should give away people's money, v'gvoa takanot l'darot. Katavti da'ati, I'm telling you, my view of v'zogam da'agon mi'brisk shlita, it's also the brisk rav's opinion, u'v'akashadeinu shemaran hadar ge'ono yamod imanu k'mosher regilim b'nei amenu l'shemar achshav. We beg that you join us in our battle against this. Right, Achoshev al dvarim anal Achoshev l'sakana. He said, "Gudar rabbanim koach melachuti b'acharad dvarim amdim rumo shel olam." Da 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 da. Right. So you see that, like Rav Kook, he thinks that this is not just a localized problem. This is a fundamental attack on Torah. But this is really, like I said, this is a major question. Before you get into the question, which in my share we'll deal with, of what mechanisms can you use and how do they work? Right. Really, the major question to ask is, is any attempt to do this against the Torah? Rav Kook, Chazanei said, yes, the Torah said sons and not daughters. That represents a principled view. Rav Herzog says, no, what are you talking about? The Gemara already recognizes that supporting daughters after death is in line with the Torah's values, and creating equivalence is what the Gemara did and what hundreds of years of Pesach have done, right? The Torah didn't say daughters don't get any support. They just said they don't inherit. But that doesn't represent a principled opposition to them being supported, right? That meta question is important before you get to the halachic question of how we do it, right? And sometimes people forget this, right? They get so caught up in the legal, right, talk that all they care about is what's the lumbus behind the mechanism and does it work, right? But they forget. Before you get there, there's a prior question, which is, should we use all of our legal acuity to come up with mechanisms that are going to circumvent the Torah? To figure that out, you've got to figure out not just what the Torah says is possible, but what it wants. Right? And that requires looking at both philosophical and agadic texts, as well as halachic texts that might channel those values. Right? And what you end up is with this major machlokes on the one side with Rukok, Chazon Ish, Priskarav, saying, no. This is against the Torah. Right? And then Rav Herzog saying, Ma pitom, that's not what hundreds of years of tradition have showed us. Right? It's not in the Gemara, it's not the tradition. And again, guys who are not in my share, you won't see it, but just you have to understand that for hundreds of years, this has been the minhag. I mean, the Rambam records it, right? It was true in Ashkenaz, it was true in Sfarad, it was true in Teman, it was true in Morocco, right? Cross-culturally, for 500 years plus, right, the consensus amongst the rabbinic community was that we have to come up with some mechanism to do this. Right? Rav Herzog is explaining where this emerges from in Chazal, that it's not against it. But this is an important question for him because it contextualizes and frames this tradition, right, and therefore justifies his expansion of it, right? But it's fundamentally a much bigger question than the local mechanisms that you use. And again, as we'll see, there were certain posts who said you didn't even need to do this, right? Moshe Feinstein follows a long tradition in the Acharonim that all you need is secular law to say that daughters inherit, and then you don't have to do anything, right? Dina Malchusa might be sufficient, right? That's like, right? But that's a radical view if you think that the Torah has a principled position to daughters not inheriting. That only works if you don't take that view, right? Because then you can, right? And that's, in my share, that's going to deal with tomorrow. Tomorrow. But I wanted to at least give you a taste of what is going on. And again, I can send you guys an English summary of all the different mechanisms we use, but I think it's important to understand the meta picture that emerges from the halacha and the hashkafa in Chazal. Right, because that really drives not just what mechanisms you use, but whether you look for mechanisms to use to begin with. Okay? Go ahead, guys.